Well, it's a great pleasure, Jeremy, to see you again after these years in Cambridge here, and have a chance to ask you one or two questions about your career in anthropology. You were born in 1928 in England, and you are the author of a number of distinguished works on saints and fireworks, Hal Farouk and Friends of Friends. This is why we wanted to talk to you. You were educated in the United States, where you read French and economics. How is it that you came to be an anthropologist?
Well, I think probably two reasons. The fact that I was an outsider for many years, both in the United States. I was the Dutchman because I had lived in Holland. My father was Dutch. And then when I lived in Holland, I was the American. So I was always an outsider looking in. I think that was the first thing that made me start asking questions about why people are different. So you had the comparative perspective, if you like, built in at a very early age. And secondly, the work I had with CARE, which is an American relief welfare organization, and with them I had was stationed in Philippines, Japan, India, and eventually Malta, and also very much as an outsider looking and having to deal with people whose customs I knew very little about, but in order to do my work properly I had to learn more about them, and spend time talking to people, but also reading, and then also meeting anthropologists in the field. And one of the supervisors I had when I was in Japan had studied for 3-4 years with BOAS, and told me, well, things that I was interested in were anthropological questions. And I suppose, again, the another influence was Lawrence Wiley, who was the author of The Village in Vaucluse, who was my French tutor, teacher at Haverford College, and became interested in the social aspects of what makes French people different from Americans. So these were some of the influences.
You mentioned Wiley. Werther and Boas, who do you think among anthropologists living or dead has influenced you most in your work?
But the first books I read on anthropology, I was stationed in Malta at the time with CARE, and the only thing available in the library there were a book by Carlton Kuhn and Kimball, Kuhn and Kimball on human interaction. It was a textbook, and they had very much an interactionist approach. But I think and that I read because there was nothing else to read, and that was 2 years before I left CARE and studied anthropology. I think that was an important influence, although something I became aware of much, much later. And in terms of the teachers, living or dead, I think, I suppose the most important influence in many, many respects is Raymond Firth, who ran the seminar that I attended for 2 years at the London School of Economics, 3 years really, although he was away one of those years, several months. And the work that I read when I was a student, and his works when I read them didn't influence me as much as the questions and the sort of orientation he had in the seminar. But the of the books I read, I think the one I, in retrospect, found most important, and I've reread, and is Edmund Leach's book, Political Systems of Climate and Burma, in which I find you have, in embryo form, very much what I think of as a transactionalist approach, looking at not necessarily moral systems and rules of residence as something God-given, coming down unchanged, but very much influenced by people competing for prestige, power. And his other book on Sri Lanka, Polidia, but particularly political systems. I think those two, if I can look back, and then later, of course, Barth's work, but that was 1963, his Models of Social Organization, I had read, and theoretically was very interesting, and was tied in with my own interests. And again, those interests are congruent with an approach that Leach had in, and I think, in political systems, and that came out constantly in the sort of questioning what's in it for them, why do people do things like that, the why question that Firth continually asked at seminars.
With your interest in and your travels around the rest of the world, it was rather strange that you settled to become one of the founding fathers of Mediterranean anthropology. You and the recent book I read, you and John Davis were the founding fathers of Mediterranean anthropology. How is it that you settled on Malta, and why did you choose to work there?
Well, that was a coincidence. The last post I had with CARE was in Malta. In Malta, life was comfortable. It was a very pleasant, small island. And when I left CARE to do field work, or to do graduate work at the London School of Economics, and then was able, wanted to go on into the field. And my first interest was, in fact, Libya. But the logistics of daily life for someone with, we had two children at the time, and an extremely limited budget, because I was financing myself through university on what I had saved while I was working for CARE, made it not very feasible to work in Libya. It was too expensive, and the health situation was such in the field that I didn't feel like risking my family's health to bring them into the field there, which would have meant a split family and an expensive sojourn. So Malta was a place that was available. My relations I had with the colonial office were good enough for the lieutenant governor there at the time. And so I put in a grant for the SSRC, and they supported me. And with the very shrewd coaching from Lucy Mayer, who was one of the examiners, and I was lucky enough to get it that year. So that's how I went to Malta, and later I went, the year after I finished my thesis, I went to Sicily, and it was then to do some work on a community development project that was staggering, and they wanted advice from an outsider. And then I began to develop Mediterranean anthropology, or European anthropology, but that's another story.
Well, we may get on to that. In Malta, you were interested particularly in the relation between religion, ritual, and politics. What, looking back over your time, struck you most about your Maltese work?
Well, the theme that I've returned to two themes constantly in what I've written subsequent to that, and that is the importance of and structure of factions, factionalism, and the second one is the way in which patrons and brokers operate. Both of these themes were very much in evidence in Malta, and something, especially the patronage and the friends of friends bit, is something that I had come in contact with as a well, you can say a welfare development bureaucrat in various developing countries, and learning that you had to work through people like that, friends of friends, contacts, people who could introduce you to the minister and pull forward a file from a whole stack of papers, that you needed intermediaries to, and people who were on your side in a bureaucracy to achieve things. So I had, in a way, been socialized networks of patronage and clientelism and brokerage when I was with CARE, and so these were familiar themes. And when I came out of the field and began to try and make sense of my data on Malta and then later on Sicily, I discovered that there was very little written on something that was such great evidence in the field. And I began asking questions: why had there been nothing written on factions? Why were temporary coalitions something, things that were virtually ignored? Why was there no way of dealing theoretically with patrons and clients? And so this grew out of both my CARE field work, if you like, and my own field work as an anthropologist in both Malta and Sicily.
Why, in fact, hadn't these subjects which helped to bring out in theory, why hadn't they been studied before?
Well, I think it's primarily because of the emphasis in British anthropology at the time on the corporate groups, the Africanist model of lineages and enduring permanent groups, and this formed a theoretical basis on which we were trained with at the London School of Economics at the time, very heavily influenced with or by African literature, and this the Evans Pritchard's model of the social structure, and there was very little room in that particular model for temporary coalitions of people manipulating the resources and opportunities available in their search for power and status. And I think this is the primary reason. And I think that that was one set, and there's another question. People weren't really interested in why questions, but that in a way is slightly different. No, I would say that it was the dominance of the structural model of society, which has little place for evolving, emerging social forms, temporary social forms. The emphasis was on chiefs and formal roles, not on the informal type of organization, although that's not a proper, a useful term.
How is it that you think you discovered this? Was it the time you were just after the great period of corporations, or was it that you went to the Mediterranean where these things were even more important and corporate kinship groups and so on were less important?
I think that's part of it. At the time, one of the big debates in British anthropology was trying to find room in the whole kinship theory for a cognitive system of kinship, and from there it was a fairly easy step towards networks and chains of friends, so the way had already been opened beyond lineages, and that I think was part of it. People were beginning to ask a series of questions about structural functionalism. Things weren't fitting together the way they should, and really you can say the time was ripe, and the Barth in a way provided some of the ways of looking at these problems theoretically. I think also important for me was the, because I didn't use the network analogy until I started analyzing my data on the migrants, Sicilian Italian migrants to Montreal, who were linked not in to each other, not in formal parishes or communities, but they were spread all over the city, but there was a whole network of kinship and links between people who originated from the same towns in Sicily. And suddenly I found that was a useful way of looking at the structure of, if you want to speak of structure, the loose networks of people that bound the Italians in Montreal to each other.
If you had to summarize what you think is the most important contribution you've made to anthropology, minutes, what would you like to be remembered?
a nasty question. I don't know, I think factions, brokers, and ultimately I hope also the legitimizing an interest in the anthropology of our own society, of Europe. And I think, I feel very strongly that anthropology is the study of all mankind, not simply primitive, non-Western, archaic man, but also people around us. And this is something that I have worked hard on in Holland. Anthropology of Europe is a legitimate field of interest in Holland, and I think this is a very important opening that anthropologists in the Netherlands have to finding employment opportunities in their own society as anthropologists, looking at problems not only of minority groups, but also essential problems within their own society, simply because you need more than a background in an African or Asian ethnography to understand some of the processes taking place in Western Europe now. And unless you've got some idea of the developments taking place and the way in which Europe, if you like, is different from Asia or Africa, you are at a disadvantage, I think, in carrying out research in Europe. So what I'm saying is that it's not always easy or feasible to transplant an anthropologist who's been trained on, say, the Australian Aborigines or African kingdoms to doing research in Europe. I think there's certain background information and research techniques, having done field work in Europe, that qualifies them for research, further research, has...
What would you say were the most important goals if you were advising a student on research in Europe? What are the...
Topic?
Well, the background factors that you mentioned.
Well, I think part of the background factors is an awareness of the history, the way of, Europe is developing, a number of the trends in Europe, I think are very important. Having also looked at in education at the a number of the trends at the moment. I, for example, am looking at a new development. I think it's a new development of the emergence of small entrepreneurs in Western Europe. Their numbers are not decreasing the way the Marxist or the macroeconomic model said they should. In fact, there's been a new discovery of the economies of small scale of, and this is something that I've been looking at and trying to understand why this is taking place, which has meant that you're dealing with the emergence of re-cottage industrialization of parts of Western Europe, an increase in small scale manufacturing in Italy, for example, particularly pronounced, but apparently this is taking place in Spain, in Greece, and even to an extent in the Netherlands.
So is this what your major current interest is at the moment? Or?
This is what I'm working on at the moment, partly because the problem interests me very much. It's a way of movement from political entrepreneurs to small commercial entrepreneurs, and partly because it is related to these long-term developments I was mentioning, and thirdly, it's an area that I think has got a certain practical relevance, in the sense that if you can get students working on this, they're working on actual developments in Western Europe at this time, which I think will help provide them with skills to that will enable them to get jobs afterwards. In this little project that I've been working on recently, we've created a number of jobs, so it's partly a job creation scheme, but partly because, and I'm interested in it, but you have to make the interest money from the Dutch government to the Dutch government, which means short-term contracts, which raises the point of can you keep doing short-term contracts and ever have enough time to think about the results. But that's part of the subject of this conference, isn't it?
Yes. Finally, Jeremy, if you were starting all over again, your life all over again, would you be an anthropologist?
Oh, yes. I've been something else. I should definitely be an anthropologist.
What else
have
you been?
Well, I've been a developer, if you like, for 5-6 years. I traveled around doing something very different from anthropology. And no, I have no regrets about being an anthropologist, and would certainly do it over again if I had the opportunity.